Here we go. Hello again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm still Alan Shartok. Within our region, lawmakers in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Pennsylvania are considering death with dignity laws during this legislative session. You know what? Vermont has had a law in place since 2013, and Connecticut failed to take any action on legislation this session. Meanwhile, around the country, only Oregon and Washington have death with dignity laws. And physician-assisted suicide is allowed with court permission in Montana and New Mexico. It's still very much a subject of great debate. Here to discuss it with us is Professor Gisa Lopez of the University at Albany School of Criminal Justice. She's author of the newly published, you can smell the pages and the print, of the book Death with Dignity, A Legal Approach to Assisted Death, which offers a history of attempts to decriminalize the practice in the United States and around the world. Professor Lopez, welcome to the Vox Pop. Let everybody know that they can do one of two things. Call us at 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. So, Gisa, tell me a little bit, if you will, about why you're so fixated with death and dying.
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. Hello to everybody out there that's listening to us. It's a pleasure to be here. How did I become fixated with it? We were chatting a little bit earlier about where I come from. I come from Brazil, which is the largest Catholic population in the world.
Interesting.
And having arrived here and being invited to write a book chapter on Jack Kevorkian, I couldn't help but to be intrigued by the practice of what many call physician-assisted suicide.
Where did you do your doctorate?
Here at the School of Criminal Justice, okay, at the University at Albany.
Right.
Yes, so my interest began there. I wrote to Jack Kevorkian, who at the time was in prison, and he wrote back, and I just became fascinated by it and decided to uncover what is a very, very long history of attempts to legalize this practice in the U.S.
Do you have a particular, I assume your position is you'd like to see it happen?
Well, not really. I think that the way it's done in Oregon appeases the criticism that has been raised over the past 100 years. There's no sign of abuse. There are many, many safeguards built into the law.
Too many?
I think they can make life difficult for the intimate decision between patients and doctors. Having said that, Vermont, as you mentioned earlier, had originally decided to keep that decision-making process between patients and doctors, and have since, as of last week, revised that so that people can have a better understanding of how many people are choosing this route, how it's being implemented, and so on.
I've never understood one thing. My mom, mm-hmm, who was a very bright lady with a doctorate and taught and all the rest of it, she used to walk around and with a vial of Seconal.
Yes.
And she used to say, "This is my nursing home."
I love it.
But of course, she didn't do that. But mm-hmm, she said it. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether she thought she was being clever or what was going on, but she said it. Mm-hmm. I mean, why do we need a law? Why can't people just kill themselves?
Well, because oftentimes people will not have access to this vial of Seconal, and they will resort to things like guns and bridges and so on. And many would argue that such deaths are violent and can be traumatizing to the family members who are left behind. That's one argument. The other argument that I think make it more palatable is that when you do have access to legally controlled substances that are usually dispensed by physicians, like a vial of Seconal, you can have what people have been calling midwives of the dying process. You
sure
can have somebody ensure that
it goes well.
It goes well, and it's not botched.
You mentioned before that you come from the world's largest Catholic population. Is that what you said?
That's right, yeah.
And so were you raised in the church?
No, I was actually baptized at age 18 at the urgency of my grandmother, who did not want to die and not meet me in heaven whenever I go that way, which so, she believed I would.
Yeah. Did you ever discuss the subject with your grandmother?
I have, actually. In fact, when she was dying, I had a chance to discuss this with her. In Brazil, unlike here, the law is very unclear, and you can make your wishes known. It's not always respected, even when it comes to the withdrawal and withholding of life-sustaining.
But the clerical part of this,
yes,
the church, of course, is against this.
Yes, the Catholic Church is very much against it. Yes,
and there is an emerging Protestantism in Latin America now, right?
Yes, there is.
And is there a difference in the way in which both religions feel about this?
No, I think the sanctity of life is universal in that context.
Yeah. So when I asked you the question and I said, "So what do you think about this?" What's the downside?
Well, I think it's a choice. So I feel people should be able to make that choice for themselves. The downside is vulnerable populations who may be urged to make one choice or another. Having said that, again, if we look at the evidence, the way the system has been implemented for almost 20 years now in Oregon does not suggest that there is a vulnerable population or that there has been abuse. In fact, people who tend to use the law in Oregon are older folks suffering typically from cancer who are 98% of them insured. About the same percentage receiving hospice care. They are highly educated. They tend to be white, married, and males. So these fears that have been articulated have not materialized as the law has been implemented in Oregon. That's the one model I stand by.
The name of your book is Dying with Dignity, A Legal Approach to Assisted Death.
Right.
What's the approach?
Well, there are many approaches, and I must tell you the title is quite misleading. I believe it should be regulated. In my mind, this is analogous to the situation of abortion. You can have it happen in the back alleys. It does happen, physician-assisted suicide, or aiding dying, as the advocates like to call it, does happen. But it's not regulated. I would like to know how it happens, when it happens, how often, precisely to avoid, to try to prevent abuse in certain situations.
1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Our guest is Gisela Lopez, and she is an expert on dying with dignity, and we are waiting your calls. I want you to call. I want you to get involved in it. That's why it's called Vox Pop, 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from the Wild Center, offering member previews of Wild Walk, 1,000 feet of elevated bridges and experiences in the Adirondack treetops. Wildcenter.org for details. Northshire Bookstore, Saratoga Springs, hosting Science Bob Flugfelder, presenting Nick and Tesla's Special Effects Spectacular, Monday, May 11th at 5:30 p.m., northshire.com. Emmerich Sales and Service announcing their annual open house featuring their Cub Cadet Ride and Drive event, Saturday from 8 to 3 at the South Glens Falls store on Route 9, emmerichsales.com. Siegel Music Colony, Schroon Lake, New York, bringing music to the North Country for 100 years in 2015 with performances and events June 20th through August 16th. SiegelColony.org for schedule. Curtis Lumber, celebrating 125 years, supporting our communities with sales, service, and supplies at 21 locations in New York and northern Vermont. CurtisLumber.com. And the Nature Conservancy's Adirondack Chapter, working to preserve freshwater resources that flow from the Adirondacks to New York's urban centers. Nature.org/Adirondacks.
Well, I am looking forward to hearing from all of you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Your call will be answered by Susie, who is a terrific phone answerer, and will give you a great break if you call. She likes to talk to people. 1-800-348-2551. You know, you have an interesting other interest that I'm fascinated by because of the Professor Lopez. We are now going through the Tsarnaev sentencing phase, and the real question is, do people really understand what it's like to be in a cell for 23 hours a day, never let out? You know, even zoos, we have tried to make them more habitable. Habitable. So can you give us a little on that?
Sure. We were chatting earlier about the idea of solitary confinement as a punishment, and people are really pushing against the way it is overutilized in the U.S. and in New York in particular. Indeed, solitary confinement comes in many forms. Some of the cells have two people instead of just one, so yeah. Solitary in that sense is a misnomer. 23 hours tends to be the period through which these people are confined. They have an hour that they can go outside. In Oregon, I believe people have come up with something called the blue screen. During that hour, instead of going to the patio to exercise, the inmates can go into a screen room where images are projected of open space and nature, which is a bit of a solution for a problem that we created. We tried to make a technical solution for something that I think should not really exist.
So I'm glad you have a position on this. Mm-hmm. Let me just make sure I get this. What is your position on it, you think? I mean, here's my position.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody's kids are walking down the street. Some heinous criminal comes, shoots them in the head.
Right.
The Boston Marathon,
we're
terrible, terrible suffering
awful.
Occurs on the part of citizens. We say, okay, we don't believe that we should put people to death. We don't believe in that. So the choices become solitary confinement or life imprisonment, you know, or the death penalty. And everybody says, well, okay. The vegetarians at the moment say, okay, I'm just kidding, say, okay, so what we want to do is put them in a cell and let them just stay there. Then I wonder whether that's what we think of that. I mean, is it, to me, that's an appropriate punishment for having taken three people's lives away.
Yeah, well, our criminal justice system is very conflicted, isn't it? Because it has to accomplish so many goals.
I know you're married to a Brit. And one of the things that's so interesting is they always say that too, isn't it? In other words, there's always a sort of thing afterwards,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it's true. I must have picked this up from him, who's also in criminal justice, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it is difficult for our system because these goals oftentimes conflict. So you have the idea of rehabilitation that we were supposed to accomplish, and I frankly cannot think that it's possible to rehabilitate somebody by putting them in a cell for 23 hours with very little human contact.
So who cares if we rehabilitate them? They killed three people.
Well, the one of the goals of our criminal justice system is to rehabilitate people so that if they ever go back, not only into the larger society.
No, you just put them in life in prison with no possibility of parole. So what do you mean, go back? Go back where?
As I was saying, if they don't go back to the larger society, at some point they have to live with the other inmates, for Christ's sake. And for a humane aspect, I think that caging humans.
No, it's caging, all right. There's no question.
Yeah. For 23 hours a day has been shown by research to have very detrimental effects on these people's
I have no doubt about that.
So I think you're seizing on an extreme, which makes for a very provocative and fun argument. But oftentimes, solitary confinement is used in New York prisons and the United States at large as a way to, quote-unquote, protect inmates from each other. They are used as punishment for infractions that are committed behind bars. And these people eventually will be released. Many of them are released directly from solitary confinement into society.
So they'll be released even though we say we're not going to release them?
No.
Oh, okay.
Yes, let's not confound the issue. So one issue is...
Got it.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't know what you said, but all five phones are ringing now, so I want to go to have people talk to you. Let's go to... actually, there's one more phone ready for you, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Lorna in Cambridge. Okay, Lorna, you're on.
Hi. I honestly didn't hear the thing about prisons, but that might have been interesting, too. I was just calling to kind of support the idea of assisted suicide. I was recently very ill, and my illness only lasted 12 hours, but it took me 4 days to recover from it. And I was thinking as I was doing it, and I am not a wimp, but I was thinking that if this is how I was going to have to feel for the next few months to recover from something like chemotherapy or something, then it better add at least 10 years to my life or it is not worth it. It was horrible suffering.
Yeah, but Lorna, before Jesus gets on, I wanted to ask you this. That makes sense to me, but what if, you know, because people get very depressed and people get very upset in difficult situations, which will pass, and they say,
right,
okay, I can't handle this, I want to commit suicide now.
I wouldn't wimp out if I thought that I was going to get better. But if I thought, like, if I were dealing with something and this is how I was going to have to live from now on, there was no joy in any of that. There was no opportunity to experience joy. And in that case, it wasn't worth it to hang on.
Okay, here comes Jesus now.
Lorna, I think you raise a couple of very important and interesting issues. The first of all is this idea of suicide. Usually, people who are going to commit suicide don't want to live anymore. The way Death with Dignity acts throughout the U.S. and in the states that allow for it works is that you have to be deemed terminally ill. So this idea that you don't want to live anymore may not be true. You know, you're choosing to die. You have to be an adult. You have to be deemed competent by a medical doctor to make that decision. You make a voluntary request that you can rescind at any time. And that request is to obtain a lethal prescription by a doctor that you will then self-administer. So there is no chance for a doctor, for example, to actually inject you with a certain substance, as it happens elsewhere, right? And this lethal medication that you are obtaining will, in effect, hasten a death that is already certain, unlike suicide, which is, as you raised, Alan, oftentimes associated with depression. And in fact, the way the law works in the U.S., in Oregon in particular, there are two physicians who are involved in the process, in the screening process, and if there is any suspicion of depression or another mental illness, the process is halted.
Okay, so Lorna, I thank you. I want to get to the other guys, but
okay.
Thank you so
Thanks.
Much for calling. Appreciate Bye. It. 1-800-348-2551. Now there are two phone, no, actually one phone left. We'll go to Ellie. Is it Ellie? Ellie
yes.
in Amsterdam? How you doing?
Yes, okay. I have just read a story in The New Yorker called The Apologizer by Milan Kundera. And the substance of the story includes about abortion, about suicide, but a person have to read the story too. But it gives a different point of view of various things.
Okay, what is giving? Because there are so many people on the phone, Ellie, it'd be great if you could sort of give us the punchline. What's the basis? It comes from a different.
There was a woman who was pregnant who didn't want to be, and she tried to drown herself. And then there's the child that resulted from this. You have to read the whole story.
Okay. Well, there's an old joke that ends, "You drew the pictures, Doc. You're the one who made the phone call." I think if we tried to come out with your point is that you should be deeply suspicious of immediate suicidal instincts. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know whether that's what I'm saying.
Oh, okay.
I've not.
Well, if you don't know, I sure don't know.
I've not called before, and I don't know how to do this.
No, you're doing very well. You're doing very well. Ellie, I appreciate it. How are things in Amsterdam, okay?
Oh, I hear there's trouble with the sewage.
Oh, boy. Yeah, and that's no reason for suicide.
I heard that on the radio. Your radio.
Our radio, you mean. Thank you, Ellie. Appreciate
it.
Yep, bye.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's go to Tom in Kingston. Tom, you're on.
Hi. How are you, doctors?
Hello, Tom.
Yeah. All right. You know, I am a little bit younger than Alan.
I think everybody is.
I have good life. My views about dying with dignity is very strong. I have discussed this with my kids, my wife. My parents who lived with me and my mother-in-law who lived with me died at very old age, like 85, 90, and 99, with help from physicians or nurses as they lived longer as I saw it. I would like to have the same exit, but obviously legally. So that's what I'm calling about. I'm interested in New York doing this along with other states. I'm a Christian by birth. I'm an atheist by practice. So I have none of those hang-ups of dying with dignity.
Okay, so let's say we're going to mark you down, Tom, from Kingston, as for it. No reservations?
Yeah.
No reservations?
No reservations.
Okay. Tom, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Joanna in South Hadley. Okay, Joanna, you're on.
Okay, 2 points I wanted to make. One is I did help to collect signatures for the death of dignity vote that was voted down in Massachusetts a few years ago.
Mm.
It was 60% for and 40% against 2 weeks before this. And then, all of a sudden, one church in Massachusetts spent close to $9 million to take out ads against this. And within 2 weeks, it went from 60-44 to 60-40 against. So I really think this is a separation of church and state issue, number one. I really hope that someone else's religion won't prohibit me from a choice that I would like to make, because I'm pro death with dignity. The second thing is I wanted to make sure, because I came in partway through the program, that VSED, voluntarily stopping eating and drinking, is mentioned, because that currently is the one legal choice people in Massachusetts and New York have, that when one voluntarily stops eating and drinking, especially the drinking part, typically people live between 7 and 10 days after they have completely stopped drinking. So a friend of mine, Lee Hawkins in Northampton, chose to do this when she was 90, and she was written up in the Daily Hampshire Gazette. There was a wonderful three-part article about her conscious dying practice. She said it's not suicide, it's conscious dying. And I'm very grateful to Lee for being able to put her life out there as an example of how she had a very loving and supported dying process.
Okay, so let's go to our wonderful Professor Gisa and see what she has to say about this.
Joanna, I think the voluntary stopping eating and drinking is a very good point that you raise. Indeed, that is legal. It's legal everywhere. When it's done with the accompaniment of physicians in terms of palliative care, it can be done painlessly. It does take a while. 7 to 10 days is typical, but it's not widespread. Some people take longer time. But indeed, it's something that people should know about. I'm very interested in the argument that you made about Massachusetts and the initiative there in 2012 and the role of the church. I don't know if you are familiar with this, but Washington State, when it passed the law in 2008 that was enacted a year later, had a flip side version of this in that the one county, Yakima County in Washington State, that had most people that were affiliated with the Catholic Church and were coming against the initiative there were also in the middle of a sexual abuse scandal. So the church did not have the same amount of money and cash available to fight the initiative there, which is exactly the opposite of what happened in Massachusetts in 2012.
And also, I have a feeling there's a different political culture in Massachusetts than it was in...
Oh, indeed.
You know.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Finally, I just want to say how much I love WAMC, and I've just retired, so now I can listen more during the day. But the fact that you continue to have these thoughtful, substantive discussions and call-in programs is so important to me. And thank you, Alan Chartok, and thank you, the speaker, and everyone who participated.
And thank you. It's a lovely thing to hear, believe me, and it means a great deal.
And I'm a member and a strong supporter. Thank you.
Thanks, Joanna. Okay, that really makes me feel good. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. So let me ask you a question, Gisa, if I may.
Yes.
What if I just held my breath? Could I kill myself?
I'm no medical doctor, but I imagine you have to do that for a long, long time.
Well, you do a little at a time, and then finally you work up to it.
Well, okay. How about not holding your breath, but instead you acquire a trash bag. You put that over your head.
Somebody did that. Somebody
does
that, yeah.
And do you inhale helium or another type of lethal gas?
So people could look. Here's the point.
Mm-hmm.
People can do this if they want to do it.
Yes, they can do it. And I think the argument here is how much cleaner do you want the process to look like, right?
Yeah.
So when you invite medical doctors to participate in it, they confer the process an aura of cleanliness, right?
Yeah.
In Switzerland, you do not, by law, need to have the involvement of a physician. And this was actually tested, and I was just mentioning the what has been called the exit bag. What happens in Switzerland is they have not-for-profit organizations who are, by law, since 1942, this is written into the Criminal Code of Switzerland, assisted suicide is legal and does not need to be given or furnished.
Interesting, right in the middle of the war.
Right, exactly. And does not need to be furnished by a medical doctor. So because they were having difficulty identifying doctors who were willing to prescribe lethal medication, Exit International, one of the major organizations in Switzerland, decided to develop what they called the Exit Kit. And that was basically a rubber band, lethal gas and a bag, and they put it over people's heads, and they themselves have to turn on the gas.
The downside of this, of course, is the whole concept of depression. I mean, people can then kill themselves. I know our wonderful Mayor Jo Gibson, the wife of Congressman Gibson, has been, you know, a big expert on suicide prevention.
If you were discussing this topic with an advocate, they would insist with you that the word to be used is not suicide, that this is very different from suicide, that these people are going to die already.
All of us.
Yes, but in these cases, predictably, if we can predict within 6 months, as defined by law, which is the terminally ill criterion in all of these laws, yes.
Yeah. Well, interesting. Let's go to Nicole in Averill Park. Okay, Nicole, you're on. Nicole, you're on.
I am, and I want to second the motion about how much I love WAMC, and you're putting these wonderful subjects on the air regularly. And I'd like to ask your guest a couple questions about her attitude towards physician aid in dying she says, or said that she wanted to know the details, the who, what, when, why, where, of chosen deaths. And I wonder how this squares with our right to privacy of our persons in our homes.
Okay, Nicole, because we're up against a very important break here, I want to give Jesus a chance to talk to you about this, and then I think we have to make a hiatus here. But go ahead, Jesus.
Okay, Nicole, I think you've identified my bias. I'm a researcher, and I seek data. So I want to know how it's happening so that I can make sure that safeguards are actually working, so on and so forth. But I appreciate the argument that this is a private decision, although all of the data that are put out there, if you Google the Department of Health from Oregon and Washington State, are de-identified. So I'm not interested in the who as much as I am in the circumstances surrounding the prescription itself. What was the underlying illness? If people are insured, so that I know that this potentially was not a decision made under coercion and things of that sort. That's my interest.
Nicole, I am so sorry we can't give you more time, but thank you for calling. Very important. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Haydenville Woodworking and Design, a group of artisans designing and building renovations, additions, new homes, custom cabinets, and furniture for over 30 years. HaydenvilleWD.com for virtual portfolio. Ye Olde Warwick Bookshop, Warwick, New York, a Hudson River Valley bookseller specializing in new and vintage books, plus collectibles and curiosities. Open 7 days a week. YeOldWarwickBookshop.com. Boyden & Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years, BoydenAndPerrin.com. The United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, working to create opportunities in education, financial stability, and health in the community. Live United, give, advocate, volunteer, UnitedWayGCR.org. Empire Exhibits and Displays, Mechanicville, New York. Custom exhibits, interactive displays, and commercial casework for trade shows, events, museums, and corporate interiors. EmpireExhibits.com. And Upstate Divorce Mediation, specializing in helping couples who are seeking a legal separation or divorce. Offices in Albany, Saratoga, and Catskill. UpstateDivorceMediation.com.
And we are here with Professor Jesus Lopes, L-O-P-E-S, but Lopez, right?
That's right.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. All five phones are ringing, so give it a little rest for a second, and as soon as somebody hangs up, you can call. I want to give everybody a chance. Now, we are in the final round of the show, so keep them short, and we'll try to give you an answer. Okay, Roger from Gloversville. Okay, Roger, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I missed the first part of the program. I understand the concept of one or two doctors agreeing the person's capable of making the decision of assisted suicide. How does it work with someone who has MS, who is incapable of doing anything?
That's a great question. In the U.S., where it's legal, you have to be able to self-administer by oral ingestion. So if you can't swallow, you can't make use of the law. That's not true elsewhere. In fact, in the Netherlands and in Belgium, you can have the physician actually inject intravenously the lethal prescription so that other people who are situated like the MS patient and so on, are able to utilize it.
Does it work? Because, as you know, we've been having a lot of trouble executing prisoners with a lethal injection.
That's right.
One other thing, a political aside, I always get a kick out of people who say they're for the death penalty and things of that nature. However, they say we also believe in the right to life.
Right. And so, and against the right to take your own life.
Right. And while gotcha. They usually say, no, you shouldn't.
Yeah. Roger, very good points. Appreciate your call. Bye-bye. Yep. All right. That leaves one line open. We'll go to Landon in Milford, Pennsylvania. Hey, Landon, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, doctor.
Hello.
Hello. My biggest concern, I mean, I would be curious as to know what types of measures would be put in place to ensure that the drug was properly administered to the individual that actually was prescribed to it, and if it were to get to the wrong hand, such as a child, for example.
Mm-hmm. Well, once again, the drug has to be self-administered by the patient who has obtained the prescription. This is highly controlled. In fact, early on, some pharmacies were refusing for one reason or another to fulfill these prescriptions.
These are in states where it's illegal.
Yes, yeah. Where it's legal. And the doctor is not going to administer this substance into the patients.
Yeah, but Landon's point is very well taken, mm-hmm. I think, in that, you know, but Landon, of course, we leave guns lying around houses, too.
True.
Would it be in the presence of the physician, and would it be a one-time injection pill, whatever it may be? Is it a one-time thing, or would it be over the course of? If so, there would be a bottle of pills that could potentially be ingested by the wrong individual.
Okay, so let me tell you how this works.
Okay.
When you are a resident of Oregon, for example, and you're deemed competent and you are an adult, which is defined as 18 and older, and you've been deemed terminally ill, which currently is somebody with a prognosis of 6 months to live or fewer, you can make an oral request to your physician. At that point, you have to wait 15 days and make another oral request.
So much.
Then you have to follow that up with a written request that's signed in front of witnesses that are not related to you and not invested in your death in any way. At that point, a second doctor is involved in the process and has to ascertain the diagnosis, the prognosis, and whether you are competent or not, and if there's any suspicion for depression, at which point
right,
it would
psychological
be...
psychological evaluation.
Yeah. Right.
But let
then,
me...
Then,
yeah,
then the only at the end of all of that, the prescription is issued, and you have to go and fulfill the prescription at a pharmacy yourself, and you bring it home, and there are two typically used drugs. Nambutal, which is the drug of choice of Marilyn Monroe, for example, and Sacobarbital. And the one that's commonly used is 100 tablets that have to be, they have to be dissolved typically with water and ingested that way. Oftentimes people take a little bit of chocolate pudding or applesauce with this amount of drug, following an antiemetic so they don't vomit the drugs, and they actually result in the death that has been sought in the process.
But it's almost the opposite. You take a multitude, a large quantity, so this way to ensure that if someone would take a small accidental dosage, it would do very little, correct?
Well, yeah, with one of these drugs, you would have to take this large amount to overdose and have death ensue.
Okay. Now, Landon, we have a lot of people coming on. I appreciate your call very much so. Thank you.
Take care.
Okay. Did you ever read the novel by John Irving, The World According to Garp?
No.
The last line says, because in the end, we're all terminal cases.
Yes, we are.
Yeah. So, so let's go to John in Montgomery. Okay, John, you should be on. Are you on?
Yes, but my name is Jan.
Jan. Oh, yeah, I can hear that. Go ahead, Jan.
Okay. I have two concerns. One is Dr. Lopez has repeatedly said that without hydration, it takes 7 to 10 days.
No, wait. Stop right there, Jan.
No, that's not what I said. One of the callers had mentioned the idea of voluntary stopping eating and drinking. And
right.
When you choose to stop drinking and eating, that caller, I think it was Joanna, had pointed out that death typically ensues between 7 and 10 days. That is true for the majority of people, but that, as I pointed out earlier, is not true for everybody. And in order for VSED to happen properly, it should be followed by a palliative care team. That's what I was saying.
I either missed a call or misunderstood. So I apologize, because I had a sister in the hospital, and nutrition and hydration were withdrawn, and it took 16 days to watch. She was given palliative care in the form of morphine, but since I was the family member that stayed with her pretty much around the clock, I had to watch her tongue blacken and dry up and the other physical changes that happened to her body. It's a horrible thing to have to watch somebody you love go through. It's not pretty.
So wait. So Jen, just so we understand what you're saying here, because we got some people behind you here, and that is that because you had to watch that, there could have been a better way. Is that?
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely. Okay. That being the only way for somebody to quote unquote die with dignity, there was no dignity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jen, a very good point, Jen. Thank you so much for calling.
And just one other thing, Alan, I know you have other people.
Yeah,
I object strongly to the 6 months or less to live criteria. I'm facing a diagnosis where I won't be able to die, but I will be a brain. I will be a brain with a body in a vegetative state.
Oh boy.
And I don't want to live like that, and right now I don't see a choice.
Yes.
Legally.
Yes. I think that's the way the American model works, with the requirement of you being terminally ill and terminal illness being defined as 6 months or less to live, is the most conservative way to go about this. Elsewhere, the criteria are different. You don't have
to
be
in other countries.
Exactly. You don't have to be terminally ill. You have to be suffering unbearably. And and that suffering can stem from a physical condition or a psychological condition.
Which is not permissible here, right?
Not here.
Right.
No, here.
Right.
And this definition of terminally ill as 6 months or less to live has come under attack. And,
yeah, I worked for hospice.
Right, The way the law works right now and adopts this definition is to keep it in tandem with the hospice requirement, actually. But they tried to change it to 1 year or less to live, and advocates from the major organizations are against that, because then it's different from the requirement for hospice, and it complicates the matter.
Jen, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Alan and Dr. Lopez. Goodbye.
Thank you.
We're going to go to Dave in East Greenbush. Okay, go, Dave.
Yeah, I just wondered, I didn't hear the first part of the show. I wonder if anybody has mentioned Final Exit Network.
Final Exit Network. No, we have not talked about them.
So Final Exit Network, Dave, you can tell us a little bit about it. Go ahead.
Final Exit Network is based on a book of the
Final
same
Exit.
Name.
Yeah,
Final
sure.
Exit, yeah.
Yeah.
And is a group of people in an organization that follow pretty much the same guidelines and principles that the professor has talked about.
Yes.
And that exist in most, in the states in this country that allow assisted suicide, or allow a suicide, I should say.
Okay.
And it is not assisted suicide. It is an educative process. It is also a guidance process. And, you know, the safeguards in terms of requiring statements from physicians and the review of the case and all that kind of stuff is all there.
Great, Dave. We are a little pressed for time, but I do say that people should just Google Final Exit, right?
Yes. Derek Humphrey, who was the president of Final Exit Network, was one of the earliest activists in this area to try to change things. They call it rational suicide, I believe, did in the mid-'80s. And his book, Final Exit, a manual of self-deliverance or something like that, was often found next to the bodies of AIDS patients in the 80s.
Interesting.
Who were choosing his manual to
sure.
Yeah.
Dave, thanks for the great call. I really do want to get to the others. Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Let's go to Paulette in Kingston. Paulette, you're on.
Hi. It's good to hear you, Dr. Lopez.
Thank you.
Glad to hear with the last caller that you did talk about palliative care a little bit, because that's my concern. I'm wondering if, with what your experience is, you've noticed that people who have adequate palliative care do not want to end their lives.
That's a great, great question. In fact, what we have learned in these 17 or 18 years that the law has been used in Oregon is that of the about 1,300 people that have obtained a prescription, roughly 800 have actually taken them. So that's issue number one. Not everybody who gets the prescription actually takes them.
But it offers them an option they can live with.
Yes. And this ability to control, or this sense of control, is very important.
Sure.
The other point is research has been conducted in Oregon that shows that palliative care knowledge, so education about it, and use has increased since the passage of the Death with Dignity Act.
And just for the rest of the world who may not be familiar with the word, I know it sounds silly, but palliative means things like morphine make the patient comfortable.
Yes, to control yeah. suffering and pain
yeah.
at the end of life.
Yeah. Okay. Paulette, thanks for the call. Appreciate
okay.
it.
Yep, bye. Thanks.
Let's go to Terry in Kingston. Terry, you're on.
Hi, very interesting show. My question is, and this probably seems a bit crass, but what about the financial mm-hmm. ramifications of these decisions? Are there laws being investigated as far as that goes? If somebody, for example, has life insurance, or, you know, does that automatically go out the window? How does that follow suit? Somebody who has children that may be entitled to a Social Security benefit, what happens there? I know it's not a great thought, but...
Okay, hey, Terry, very good questions. Let's get an answer.
Okay, so the cause of death that goes on the death certificate of people who have taken the prescription in Oregon and the other states where this is legal is actually your natural illness that was going to take you away at one point or another. So insurance issues do not get triggered, because on your death certificate, you died of the underlying illness and not...
Well, we know insurance companies aren't always the nicest people in the world.
That was going right. to be my next question. Yeah. Is no, if the insurance foresees, you know, if we think that there's going to be a problem down the road, if they're going to start to...
It's built into the law.
Okay.
Yes, no, there's no concern about that.
Okay, Terry, that was a great question. Thank you very much. Okay, here's one that has come in over the internet, and we only have a short time to do it in. What if you have a history of depression but fit all the prerequisites for death with dignity? Would you be denied? Thanks.
If the second doctor comes along, as I had mentioned throughout the process, and identifies that you're still depressed, clinically depressed.
Now, in other words, it's not the history, it's that you are
it's
now.
At that point, yes.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. Okay, guys, that's it for now. We have to go. Gisa Lopez, this was a wonderful show. You must promise to come back again.
I will, thank you.
And the name of your book is Dying with Dignity, A Legal Approach to Assisted Suicide by Prager, published by Prager. We're out of time. Thanks, everybody, for calling. Support for the Vox Pop comes from Habitat Post and Beam, South Deerfield, Massachusetts, designing and manufacturing energy assistant post and beam homes and additions throughout the Northeast since 1972. Postandbeam.com. Vision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or VisionExcelEyeCare.com. And Great Camp Sagamore, a national historic landmark at Racket Lake in the Adirondacks, open for accommodations, tours, and events since 1897. GreatCampSagamore.org. Washington County Tourism, featuring Battenkill-inspired events and activities, including culinary galleries, outings, music venues, and outdoor happenings, WashingtonNYCounty.com. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. We're almost out of time, but I do want to thank Susie Chekai, our wonderful phone answerer, the incredible Zach Malloy, and Jessica Blaustein Marshall, who found our wonderful guest, and we are so very grateful. Stay tuned now for a news update.